This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, October 19th, 2020, and this is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Ahead for this first day of early voting in Arkansas, a guide for voters from a Bentonville nonprofit, plus a guide for Northwest Arkansas for emerging from the pandemic, and in our second half hour, another audio history tour with Randy Dixon from the Pryor Center. This week, the complicated process of trying to rid Arkansas prisons of abuse, neglect, and corruption. Arkansas's cases of COVID-19 will soon pass 100,000. This weekend, more than 1,200 confirmed cases and another 288 probable cases brought the state's cumulative case count to just more than 99,000. 39 more deaths attributed to the virus were reported on Saturday and Sunday, meaning more than 1,700 Arkansans have died from the disease. Hospitalizations did drop by 18 over the past 2 days. Today is the first day for early voting across the state. Polls in several locations are open today, and early voting continues most days until Election Day proper, Tuesday, November 3rd. It was a pretty good weekend for Arkansas Razorback teams. The women's cross-country team, ranked first in the country, easily won the Blazer Classic in Alabama. The women have now won 9 consecutive meets. The number 4 in the country men also won their race at the meet. The volleyball team won its first 2 matches of the year, sweeping a pair at Mississippi State. The football team won its first home SEC game since 2016 Saturday afternoon with a victory over Mississippi. And the number 3 soccer team lost, dropping 2-1 to number 15 South Carolina at home Friday night. This is Ozarks at Large. Heartland Forward is releasing today a new report that proposes a pandemic-related economic recovery strategy for Northwest Arkansas. The Walton Family Foundation provided the grant to undertake the study. Ross Duvall is president and CEO of Heartland Forward, which describes itself as a nonpartisan, nonprofit think and do tank focused on improving economic performance in the center of the United States. Late last week, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda spoke with Duvall about the report. He says the study was prompted by local leaders who asked him to convene a group of thought leaders for a webinar on how COVID-19 changes the perspective of economic development, the way we interact, and the future of cities, especially in the Heartland.
It eventually led to a discussion around what can communities do to position themselves better to come out of COVID-19. Which evolved into the much more specific question of what could Northwest Arkansas do to position it better to come out of COVID-19 even more competitive for economic development, culture, the arts, a whole wide area of activities.
So the report came up with these 7 different recommendations, you know, to help the economy. One of those is becoming the Heartland's leading region for talent. And one way to do that is through a talent moonshot initiative. What might something like that look like?
So we called it a talent moonshot initiative because we were trying to put together some really big ideas that could be impactful. So there's a series of kind of incremental improvements and transformational change. And the moonshot idea is truly transformational. It would look at trying to provide financial support to bring some of the best and brightest creative types from the arts, from STEM backgrounds, academics, potentially some business leaders, and especially younger leaders that may be on the coast today, that might not have ever thought about to moving someplace like Northwest Arkansas. But because of COVID-19 and not wanting to be in such dense places and being able to have a higher quality of life, we might be able to recruit some of those talented people here. And so it would be an initiative to recruit 100 of the best and brightest. We could potentially do it 20 a year for 5 years, but it would really be transformational. And then there's a whole series of other ideas around trying to be the country's best small region for attracting talent.
So another suggestion is growing the economy in Northwest Arkansas and jobs around some of our big anchor companies. We are a unique space where we have, you know, J.B. Hunt, Tyson, Walmart. These are all Fortune 500 companies. So how would you do that? How would you go about convincing these companies to add more jobs?
The idea is that we have kind of a unique cluster, I would call it as an economist, in terms of the companies that are here. We have a leading retail company, certainly in the United States, if not the world, Walmart. We have one of the innovators in logistics and transportation, J.B. Hunt. And then we have Tyson Foods, which is a leader in protein. And combined, there's this kind of unique cluster around logistics, supply chain management, retail. And this is an area of expertise for the University of Arkansas. They were voted having the number one supply chain management program for at the bachelor's degree just in the last 2 months. They've received that recognition. And there's a real opportunity to view this as a, we call it a industrial commons and supply delivery and logistics that could be formed that shares information, allows them to become more competitive by being part of this leading ecosystem, if you will, around supply chain and filling in some of the suppliers around that because of COVID-19 who might have flown in on a weekly basis that now people may not want to do that, but they need to maintain some in-person presence that we could relocate more of them here on a permanent basis.
And this may be a little outside the scope of the report, but it got me thinking, you know, adding these jobs or growing the economy. Right now, things are pretty good for these companies in terms of, you know, everybody's got to eat. You know, people don't want to go out as much. So logistics are important so you can get your stuff ordered online and transported to you. But as the pandemic lingers on, if it goes on longer, people may be tightening their budgets. Consumer spending may go down and it may be more difficult to convince, you know, companies to add more, to think about growth, right? Because they'll be thinking about saving money too. So in that instance, would this still be applicable or how would they still be able to implement this suggestion under those conditions?
Well, this is much broader than just the support from those companies, but that's an excellent question. It really is an industrial commons and would require some financial support from either philanthropy or the public sector with the university and working more closely together. So I would view this as an opportunity. It remains to be seen what happens in Washington in terms of another stimulus package. But the moral of the story is we can't rely upon Washington, D.C. to solve our problems. We have to solve them ourselves. And out of great tragedies, there come opportunities. You can look back at other evolutions. Some of the leading companies today came out in 2007, just prior to the Great Recession and the financial crisis. And so companies that are at the leading edge that make transformational change through investing could come out ahead when we resume something that resembles a normal, whatever the new normal becomes.
Another suggestion from the report is to make inclusion and diversity a regional priority. Makes sense given, you know, the national conversation that we have with systemic racism right now and, you know, other topics like police reform or the Confederate monuments or even voter suppression. So what does diversity and inclusion look like through the lens of the economy? How does that help an economy that's been impacted by this pandemic?
Because more than ever, we have discovered that talent is our most important asset. And now that we have an opportunity, many of the big tech companies are allowing remote work, many through July of next year have already announced that. So there's the opportunity to attract talent here that otherwise may not feel that Northwest Arkansas might be as open or welcoming. And trying to think about inclusion in terms of the arts and culture, and making the pitch that Northwest Arkansas is more attractive than people realize that don't live here. And so it's about bringing in the art, the creative talent, and connecting it. Because quality of place, as I would put it, quality of life, others might suggest, is really critical in attracting talent, and talent is essential for building a vibrant economy.
And this report specifically focuses on Northwest Arkansas, but could other regions use it as a template for ways to be proactive about their economic growth?
This initially started out as a discussion about what the heartland could do to make itself more attractive. But in looking at Northwest Arkansas, I think there's a lot you can learn that could be applied to other places. One, you need to determine your own destiny. You can't rely upon Washington or others to solve your problems for you. Certainly you like to have their support. But think about the actions that you could take as a community, whether it's philanthropic investments in the art, whether it's trying to create a remote worker program, you might be able to recruit workers for some period of time who might be able to stay here longer after they see the quality of life. So the idea is each location, especially those in the heartland, should be thinking about the unique qualities that they have and the actions that they could take to make themselves look more attractive. People were already leaving the coast. There was net migration out of the West Coast. I'm among them. I came here from Los Angeles. And you find a lot of it occurring from San Francisco, the Bay Area, New York, and the kind of the Northeast Corridor. So New York, LA, had been losing population prior to COVID-19, the last 2 or 3 years. High housing prices, lots of friction in life. And as not only baby boomers, people that are my age and slightly younger, are moving here. We've seen millennials, that generation, begin to look at the heartland again. Once again, quality of life, housing prices, arts, recreation, a slightly slower pace, not spending an hour and a half commuting each way as I did for 20 years in Southern California. And so I think when you combine what was happening already prior to COVID-19 with COVID-19, there's an opportunity for places in the heartland, and Northwest Arkansas could set the example for how do you re-envision, reimagine yourself and develop a plan, and more importantly, to move on implementing it, not to allow it to be platitudes. So I have been involved in providing guidance on plans such as Silicon Valley did. Joint Venture Silicon Valley came up with a plan for recovery released about a month and a half ago. It's a nice glossy report. It has lots of platitudes, but there's no series of specific actions and recommendations on what should be done. And that's what we've done with this strategy, is to develop not only the broader strategy, but the actual items that could be implemented. I guess in closing, what I'd like to add is it is critical to not waste time and begin moving on this, because Northwest Arkansas has a real opportunity to be out ahead of other communities and take advantage of such things as remote work, moonshot talent. We could recruit a group of really top-notch leaders that perhaps were never aware of Northwest Arkansas. But given all the investments that have been made here and that could be made, it's an opportunity to change the future direction of this region.
Well, thank you so much for your time and discussing the report with us today. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you, Antoinette.
That was Ross Duvall, president and CEO of the Bentonville-based Think and Do Tank, Heartland Forward. He spoke with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda late last week. The new Northwest Arkansas Economic Recovery Strategy Report is available now at heartlandforward.org.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
This is Ozarks at Large. As so many other nonprofit organizations have had to do this year, Bentonville Soup is switching gears a bit. Board member Marcy Ouellette says normally the group promotes community-based development by hosting crowdfunding dinner events with the aim of fostering creativity, collaboration, and democracy.
And that comes to fruition by us having a potluck dinner where we have 4 community presenters. Everyone that comes to our dinner, it's a suggested $10 donation. And then everyone that comes after they get to hear the presenters pitch their ideas. Everyone gets a vote, and the winner takes all the proceeds from the door.
But in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, board member Brad Lala says they decided to put their energy into a different project.
It's funny, we'd had a couple of Zoom meetings since March, trying to figure, you know, you looking at the calendar and being hopeful and going, well, can we have it later in the year? And it was apparent really early that 2020 was kind of a wash for in-person events. And so we started brainstorming as a group on what could we do that still supported our mission of community involvement and increasing democracy, and a voter's guide for Bentonville just seemed to make a lot of sense.
The voter guide includes all local, state, and federal level races that will show up on Bentonville voters' ballots. Olette says residents will be able to view information about the candidates for Bentonville City Council, Benton County Quorum Court, the Arkansas House and Senate, the U.S. House and Senate, as well as the three ballot initiatives known as Issues 1, 2, and 3.
And so what we've gone ahead and done is we asked all the candidates three questions, which the majority of those came from the community, sent that out to them, and we've posted their responses and their social media or campaign pages. For the ballot initiatives, we went ahead and put the ballot initiatives as they will be on your ballot, but we also went ahead and broke it down for you, saying a yes vote means this and a no vote means this, to demystify a little bit of that language that sometimes can be confusing on those.
Bentonville Soup asked each candidate the following questions. How will you keep your constituents engaged in government after the election? What is your plan to make your district or ward a more welcoming place? And what are two things, one large and one small, you want to change about Bentonville? More than half the candidates sent back their responses. Lala says it's easy to find information about major races, like the one for president, but that's not always the case for races taking place on the city and county levels.
We were really hoping those questions would help people get to know the candidate better if they haven't had a chance to go see him at a local event or because of COVID. But something that a lot of people forget is, you know, the most impactful vote you can have is for your local candidates. They're the ones that are going to be helping to make policy for anything, whether it's building a sidewalk in front of your house or your kid's school, or, you know, determining what tax rates are going to be over the next few years. And so those are, and we lose sight of that, I think, in all of the hubbub with the larger races, and we wanted to help bring some more attention to that.
It becomes especially difficult to know the candidates when some races, like those for city council, have three or more candidates on the ballot. And Olette adds, Bentonville residents get to vote on all the city council races, regardless of what ward they live in, which means they'll be looking at a lot of names when they go to vote.
This year, with everything that's going on with the presidential election, as well as COVID and natural disasters, it just feels like there's a lot of buzz going on around so many different things at this time that researching who you're going to vote for on your ballot may be a little bit more difficult this year with what everyone has on their plates. So we definitely wanted this to be a resource that people could use prior to showing up at their polling location to vote and kind of take a little bit off of their plate that they don't have to worry about that.
You can access the voter guide by going to BentonvilleSoup.com. We have a link at KUAF.com and OzarksAtLarge.com.
It was a dark and evil place, needless to say, but it was really unreal.
This is Ozarks at Large. With me is Randy Dixon, who is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. I say with me. Randy's on the phone. How are you, sir?
Good, Kyle. How are you?
Hanging in there. I want to, before we go into this week's trip through the Pryor Center archives, these are digitally remastered archives that have come out of the KATV library and live now on the Pryor Center's website. Before we do that, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we did a segment that was kind of connected to infamous crimes in Arkansas's past. Last week, talked about the beginning of prison reform. This week, more about prison problems through Arkansas's history. A reason that you've taken this course over the last 3 weeks or month or so, or is it just happenstance?
It's just happened that way. I came across the Tom Merton material, and he was the guy right. that the movie Brubaker was based on. And there was just so much more to the story on the prison reform. So it all just kind of worked out that way. But I found a lot that didn't include Tom Merton that we can sort of back up a little bit and go beyond.
Okay.
That one less than a year period when all the scandal broke, because it built up to that and then continued after.
Well, what did we hear to begin this week's segment?
Well, that was retired Supreme Court Chief Justice Jack Holt, who he was describing the prison system as a dark and evil place, which is he was quoting Judge J. Smith Henley when he ruled that the Arkansas prison system was unconstitutional. And the reason I talked to Jack Holt is that he was a young attorney who knew Judge Henley, and Judge Henley called him right before Christmas and said, "Do you know a young attorney named Phil Kaplan?" And he said, "No." He said, "Well, you're about to," because he had the two of them take the pro bono case of the conditions of the prison system when they when it was found to be unconstitutional. So it starts off with Judge Holt as a young man in 1966 when he talks about the judge's ruling.
Well, I think the court in its previous opinions pretty well pointed out that we must have what we call a degree of constitutional standards, in other words, humane treatment. Humane treatment, you might say, paraphrasing, that the institution itself must not be a form of punishment, which we feel like in the past it has been due to the dismal conditions, the treatment, the forms of punishment. And, of course, any lawyer that's been in this for a while thinks perhaps he knows all the answers. He doesn't. We have our own impressions of what might work, what might not work, but I think we can say this in summary. We know that the system we have had in the past has not worked at all.
Prisons have always been a big part of the state of Arkansas's budget and have always kind of been there. And as we're going to find out this week, there have been significant problems with the Arkansas prison system over the past several decades.
Yes. And, you know, they were supposed to be self-contained units with farms and provide for themselves and make a profit some years. But the entire system was corrupt. It was deep-seated. There was violence. There was torture, lack of food. They had the inmates working 24-hour or 14-hour work days. Mm-hmm. And the worst part of it is they called it the trustee system. And you're familiar with that,
yes,
Kyle.
Yes.
But if for any of the listeners who aren't, there were no real guards. There were maybe only a couple or a handful. The rest were prisoners, and they called them trustees because they were trusted to carry a gun and watch the other prisoners. But I had the chance to talk to Jack Holt, and retired judge, was the attorney on the case, and he talks about the trustee system some 50 years later.
Penitentiary was run, in a sense, by other inmates, trustees. It was a trustee system. The trustees, the guards, most of the guards, the tower guards, were trustees. They were people who were confined, and they had to select someone that would be inclined to shoot a fellow inmate if he tried to escape.
You also talked with Jim Pitcock, the longtime KATV news director and reporter, about this era. What did he have to say?
Well, he saw it as a flawed system, and he sort of describes the way the media saw it.
Most of the trustees were violent, and the reason they were trustees, because the other inmates knew that they were in for a violent crime like murder or what have you, and they knew that they could get shot by a trustee for little or no apparent reason.
As one might suspect, these problems then boil over and become much bigger problems. There was a period in Arkansas where there were prison riots.
And a lot of that had to do with the fact that they were getting rid of the trustee system. They were bringing in real guards. But when these trustees, who had been sometimes brutally disciplining their fellow inmates, are suddenly back in the barracks with them. And it caused problems. They were escaping on a regular basis. And it was just, I guess you could just call it a mess down there at Cummins and Tucker. And Jim Pitcock talks about one of these riots that really started bringing these problems to the media's attention.
We had what I call the Labor Day riot, when they had to call in about 100 state troopers over the Labor Day holiday. And I believe it was in, I think it was either 65 or 66. And they, at the time, they had the barracks type facility. There might be 100 inmates in a long barracks. And so they started rioting, and they called in all of the state troopers, and I don't remember if anyone was hurt, but we went, they let us in the next day. And at the time, Dan Stevens had been replaced as superintendent by the former sheriff of Union County down in El Dorado, a fellow by the name of O.E. Bishop. And I remember Mr. Bishop took us through the barracks, and there were bullet holes all along the ceiling where they had shot over the inmates to quell the disturbance. And that was really the beginning. When the major problems came to the forefront.
It's Jim Pitcock, who is a longtime news director and reporter at KATV. Yeah, the media does begin to seize on this, and I think a lot of people in the public were surprised at some of the policies that were going on in Arkansas prisons at this time. And now you have to do, I don't know if you'd call it spin, but there's some media relations that the correctional department tries.
Sure, and it was coming, they were pretty open about it. And this is an example. Jim was describing this Labor Day riot, and the superintendent at the time was a fellow by the name of O.E. Bishop, who had been the sheriff down in Union County. And Governor Faubus had asked him to sort of step in and be superintendent and warden. And so he's giving a tour of the area, the barracks, after this riot that Jim had described.
Just sort of explain how the bullet holes got in there. We're going to record
this. Well, we've already explained that. Well, you know, when the riot broke out in here, well, then I ordered to fire. When the gas didn't break them up and they had attacked the trustees, then I ordered them to fire over the heads, which we'd already discussed. Of course, the first fire, well, they all hit the floor. Then the trustees were all out except one. He ran out.
And, as you might think, it's a pretty thankless job to be doing this, so O.E. Bishop decides he doesn't want to do it anymore.
Right. You know, it's like, I did this because Faubus asked me to. I'm a sheriff. Nobody's given me any money or resources, support. So, yeah, he just up and quits.
I just felt like that it would be better that I resign and get out, because I had reached the point where I could not operate or run the penitentiary like I thought it should be run.
And is this where Tom Merton, who Robert Redford was based on in the movie Brubaker Comes In?
Yes, and he really brought the media attention. A lot of folks, his critics, said he was showboating, you know, and pointed out too much. But he pointed out the strap, which was a form of beating, the Tucker telephone, which was a form of torture, using electric shock. And then he started digging up graves and claimed that they were inmates who had been murdered, and the Rockefeller administration was very embarrassed about this. And within 2 months after he had exhumed these bodies, he was fired. And as a matter of fact, he was told he had 24 hours to get out of the state or he would be arrested for grave robbing.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, which is a charge that he could have gotten 21 years under state law. So he hightailed it. Mm. So in comes Bob Sarver, and he is wanting to bring much more change. And this is right after Judge Henley's ruling on the unconstitutionality of the prisons. And this is Bob Sarver's response.
It has slapped our hands rather hard, and one of the major items is that as a result of our inadequate free world security force, the lives and safety of the inmates in the institution is certainly in jeopardy. We've had, as the judge pointed out, 17 stabbings in the past 18 months at Cummins alone. We don't have free world men to guard. The judge has suggested in the order that free world people be hired or employed to replace the so-called floor walker who walks the floor in each of the 8 barracks at night to see to it that the men are sleeping or at least staying in their own bunk areas. At this point in time in the Arkansas prison system, on any given night, a routine night, there will only be 3 free world people on duty to supervise at Cummins over 900 men and at Tucker almost 300 men.
So we've gone from Bishop to Merton, to Sarver. In those 3 administrations, have the conditions, I mean, are they getting better?
You know, a spotlight has been put on them. But the conditions, you know, it was taking time, governmental type time, to make these changes, and they continued to be dismal, as Jack Holt here describes them.
It was a dark and evil place. The lighting was poor. The ventilation was poor. There wasn't any air conditioning. The overcrowding of the barracks that were built for, say, 70 had 140 in it with double beds stacked up, twin beds, and which was also very convenient for some people if they wanted to creep on others, where they call them that. If they had it in for another inmate, they creep over there with a knife or something, which they had made it down at the barn, taking a file or something, made it out of knife. They had homemade knives around there. There was quite a few assaults of inmates over inmates, and it was a dark and evil place.
That is Jack Holt. We are talking about the public spotlight that was put onto Arkansas prisons decades ago. We're going to continue this discussion on today's Ozarks at Large right after this. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellens. With me on the phone is Randy Dixon, who is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. We're going through Pryor Center archives that remind us of the conditions of Arkansas prisons in the 1960s, 70s, and moving into the 80s. We're doing this with archives that have been digitized, archives that come from both KATV's archives and some conversations that Randy has had in the past few weeks. Where do we pick up the story?
Well, this is in the middle of these changes that are coming across very slowly. And I came across this sound clip of the chairman of the state prison board at the time. And he was at a civic group, and he was describing improvements, but also described the prisons as a slave camp.
And if he fouls up driving a tractor, why, you just lay him down and beat the bejesus out of him like they did in the old days. Any slave camp can only be efficient with the use of the strap. They didn't build the Egyptian pyramids by offering the slaves an ice cream cone at the end of the day. The Roman galley slaves were not offered little inducements. They beat them. But fellas, we're not running a slave camp. That day is long since passed, and the courts have said that it should not be a slave camp. Our board, 3.5 years ago, outlawed the strap and all other forms of brutality. And we must all understand that you sacrifice efficiency when you try to save human beings. But that's a price that we must pay.
Now, earlier, we've heard from Jack Holden. Earlier, you mentioned the person that he would be working with, Philip Kaplan, also a young attorney at the time. What sort of work did they do together toward the conditions of the prison and the developing legal cases?
Well, in building their case to take before Judge Henley, they were given complete access. And going through all these, it kind of surprised me as, you know, a former journalist that they were so open. Let cameras in, and apparently to Judge Holt, they allowed he and Phil Kaplan pretty much the run of whatever they wanted to see and wherever they wanted to go.
Phil Kaplan and I were appointed by Federal Judge Smith Henley. We were given an open door to the organizations with instructions to the penitentiary and its officials that we were to have access to the entire unit at any time and any place under any circumstance and not be prohibited to interview, take pictures of the premises. The staff was very cooperative in giving us that permission.
We've talked about the Labor Day riot. In 1970, there was a riot, and this one created headlines again, partly because Sarver's taken hostage?
Yes, wow. Yes, and he describes it basically right after he got out.
Their grievances were pretty generally the same grievances that they've had all along, the fact that the system is unconstitutional. They don't feel that we're moving fast enough, I guess, in eliminating the evils that the federal court pointed out. Very little new. Their grievances concerned lack of eating utensils, sanitary facility conditions in the isolation facility, this kind of thing.
Mr. Sarver, what was the attitude in those meetings? Was it hostile?
It was at first, of course, quite hostile. I sat in a cell, the third cell on the left as you go in. One of the men sat across from me with a pistol. The other one was up on top of the cells with a pistol. Near the entrance to the unit, we had 5 to 7 men in the cell most of the time as we talked and negotiated. I would say after I'd been there about 2 hours, common sense began to prevail, and at least they understood that we were trying and doing as much as we can with what we've got in the shortest period of time.
Did they, in fact, Mr. Sarver, hold you as hostage at gunpoint?
They did, yes.
What will be the action that the prison will take now toward these men?
I really don't know at this point. We're simply grateful that we got our free world men out alive. That was highly questionable this morning at 3 o'clock. and we got our trustees out alive. I really don't know. It's something that Mr. Steed and his staff and I will have to give some heavy consideration.
Now, that's the second riot we've talked about. What else can you tell us about this?
Sarver made a lot of changes. One was he eliminated the trustee system, but he also worked on integrating the living quarters of the inmates, and that caused problems. So there was yet another riot. And this is the news coverage of the incident that includes interviews with Sarver and with the state police.
Well, it began, of course, on Friday, I believe, at noon when the men were coming in from the field, from the West Long Line. At that time, there were approximately 100 men involved. Those 100 remained involved for the most part throughout. By the time the eruption came last night, roughly one half our population was involved. Now, most of that half was not directly aggressively involved, but certainly were involved. It largely centered around a small core in each barracks of black militants, a small core of white radicals, each ribbing and agitating the rest of the men in the population. Many of them, of course, didn't want any part of it, but were afraid and just simply through fear went along.
Well, we'll be here all day because we're shaking down the barracks and we're shaking down all of the prisoners so that we've got 50 men actively working here now. And at the end of the day, Mr. Sarver and others and I will confer and decide how much longer we need to stay and in what force.
And so the situation at Cummins, which in the past 2 days has been described equally as highly explosive and one of the worst in history, seems to be quelled, for the moment at least. This is Claude Locke reporting.
And as is often the case in these dire situations, there might be some more money, but probably not as much as was needed to correct years' worth of neglect and abuse. But Sarver does say in this next clip, I believe, that things have gotten better?
Yes, that even with the shortages, he's made improvements in, you know, one of the things was eliminating the trustee system, but he defended the work that he had done.
We've cleaned it up. We've improved the food service appreciably. We're doing the best we can to give every man at least 3 sets of clothes, which is something for us, considering what it used to be. I think, frankly, we've taken over the institution finally, for the most part. We'd still state-owned and inmate-operated. It's going to be that way until we get enough staff to handle it.
I mentioned when Mr. Bishop was the director of prisons, it was a thankless job. Merton lasts less than a year, is given a day's notice to get out of state. Not surprising that Sarver is told unceremoniously to leave as well.
Yes, you know, like Merton, he made enemies. And in this interview, he pretty much sees the handwriting on the wall.
Well, I was hired as Commissioner of Department of Correction by the Board of Correction a little over 2 years ago. To do a specific job here, and I have tried to the very best of my ability to do the job the way I felt it should be done and the way I felt would be in the best interest not only of the people in the system but the people of the state of Arkansas. I continue at this point trying to do that job, and I'll keep on doing it. I think it goes without saying that when one approaches his job that way, it's inevitable that he makes enemies.
And now let's bring in a couple of other figures to this prison story that maybe they're not names that you would initially think should be here, but then if you have followed Arkansas history, you go, oh, of course, Winthrop Rockefeller and Johnny Cash.
Yeah, and I just wanted to throw this in because this did happen while Sarver was there, and Sarver came up on stage at one point during the performance, and in 69, Johnny Cash and his wife and his band all came, and I believe the Statler brothers were there. And, you know, this had been popularized by his performances at Folsom Prison and San Quentin. And he came to Cummins, and he had a couple of things to say.
You know, we didn't know too much about Cummins and Tucker until today when we came down, and in the car, we talked to the men that were from the prison here about a lot of the things that go on here. We didn't talk about a lot of other things that go on here, I guess. Sure we didn't. But I learned quite a bit about Cummins Farm. And I learned that there are some people trying to help you fellas. I hope they are. They say they are, and it looks like they really are. I know our governor's trying to help you.
Let's sum this up. What do we know about the case? Because the prison system's ruled unconstitutional.
You know, improvements were made. They did deal with a lot of the corruption. And one of the last things I asked Judge Holt, you know, it's been 50-plus years since he was involved with the case. And, he's kept up with the prison system over the years. But I just asked him, you know, what he thought of the outcome of the case today.
Well, I think the significance of it was that it caused a complete change of the operation of the penitentiary, from health care to facilities to food service and to actually improve the premises, too. The living conditions were, I would say, not satisfactory.
Well, okay. I know that usually when you and I talk, you're not quite sure what will be coming next, but I look forward to it.
Maybe something fun. How's that?
We've done crime, prison. Maybe so. But I'll leave that up to you because they're always interesting. You can find out so much more if you put Pryor Center into a search engine. It's the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. Randy Dixon, as always, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for sharing these with us.
You had a great time. See you next week.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Hartford. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Contributors to this Monday edition of Ozarks at Large included Antoinette Grajeda and Zuzana Sitek. Zuzana delivering sound and information about the Voter's Guide in Bentonville. Timothy Dennis produced today's show. Our thanks to Randy Dixon with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History for allowing us to have more access to archives from the Pryor Center. We'll have Randy back next Monday as well. You can listen to Ozarks at Large when you want by asking your smart speaker to please play Ozarks at Large or by subscribing to our free podcast service that's available through all the major podcast distributors. You can also at KUAF.com sign up for our free afternoon newsletter that gives you links to everything that was on that day's show. This is 91.3 KUAF. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Kyle Kellens. We'll be back with you tomorrow at noon and 7.